from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, and welcome. You have landed on Rated LGBT Radio, and I am Rob Watson. Tonight we have an important discussion. The Supreme Court was, well, I don't want to say they're active. They took action that affected a couple of cases that are pretty pertinent, and one of which was the ban on transgender service members. And we're going to find out exactly what they did or did not do, the effect of it, the complexity of the case as it is in numerous courts throughout the country. And to do that, we've invited one of our favorite guests, Shannon Minter of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, a good friend of the show, and Shannon has been on before. Thrilled to have him back on tonight. We are going to pick his very big brain about all that is going on. Speaking of picking big brains, I'm going to bring on one of the biggest brains I know, especially in the journalistic world, my good friend and co-host, Brody Levesque. Welcome, Brody.
Good evening, Rob. It's going to be good to talk to Shannon again. Good evening to our listeners. And on that happy note, I want to put a shout out. The 31st annual Creating Change Conference is going on right now in Detroit. So I want to give my best and the show's best to all of our friends in the LGBTQI community and others in the progressive movement who are attending Creating Change. And it's kind of a very necessary thing, and sadly and unfortunately, these days. We've had a couple of other things happen that I think that we need to note, one of which I think we can probably also discuss with Shannon. In Utah, the legislature now has a newly introduced House Bill 153. This bill would amend provisions regarding the completion and amendment of birth certificates in Utah, which would prohibit transgender citizens from being able to change the gender on their birth certificates or parents to effect a change. So that's currently going on right now in Utah. Another little thing of note, Brian Brown, our dear friend who used to run NOM and who now runs something called the World Congress of Families, is making a lot of noise because he got on MSNBC and says that Representative Tulsi Gabbard must apologize for insulting Christian Americans by apologizing, okay, for her anti-LGBT past. He also put that out in a press statement. GLAAD has decided that they're going to remove the Bohemian Rhapsody film from contention for a GLAAD Media Award. Earlier this week, a rather long investigative piece by The Atlantic magazine was published on the film's director, well, one of the directors, Bryan Singer. Singer has had numerous allegations over the years of inappropriate sexual contact with minor children, boys. And in the Atlantic article this week, they sourced about 50 different sources, and they spent about a year on the investigation, and they've raised a pretty ugly picture of Singer. And even though he has, through his attorney, denied it, he labeled it homophobia and a few other things. Singer's had a well-established reputation, at least with some in the film community, for being problematic in that regard. So GLAAD apparently decided that they were going to pull back, the award for the film Bohemian Rhapsody. In South Bend, Indiana, we have a military veteran and an openly gay mayor, Pete Buttigieg, who has indicated that he's forming an exploratory committee for a run at the presidency of the United States. Now, some in my media circles have said he's the first time, you know, candidate. That's not true. Actually, another friend of our show, Fred Carger, was the first openly gay man on the Republican ticket to run for that high office. So we have that going on. And then the last thing that I'm going to mention, and this is something that really truly bothers me, and maybe Shannon could kind of maybe later weigh in on this too. The Department of Health and Human Services this week issued a waiver to a South Carolina foster care agency. And in the waiver, and this was written by another friend of the show, Zach Ford, who is right now at Creating Change. Zach, as you know, is the LGBT editor of Think Progress. Essentially, what this waiver does is it gives Miracle Film Ministries the ability to refuse to partner with any foster parents that do not share its Christian beliefs, and it has already got a track record of already turning away Jewish and same-sex couples. Now, what makes this particularly difficult was that President Trump has an ally in South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster, and McMaster personally went after HHS to secure a religious exemption from the federal non-discrimination laws for that Christian foster care agency. And essentially, without the exemption, that ministry would probably lose its license. And this is one of those things where, you know, this particular Miracle Here Ministries from Greenville, South Carolina, you know, is in trouble because it was refusing to place foster children with non-Christian families, Jewish, Muslim, same-sex couples. And like any other agency that participates in foster care programs and receive federal funds under an Obama-era rule, they'd be, you know, they would be barred from discriminating on the basis of religion. And like I said, this week, the agency was granted the waiver to the rule that was put into place by the Obama administration, which barred any child placement agencies that received public funding from that kind of discrimination. Despite the waiver, Health and Human Services has not taken a further step of attempting to overturn that particular rule. All it's simply done is just this particular agency, and it's Zach reported in his piece, the CEO of Miracle Hill, Reed Lehman, had said, and I'm quoting, "God's design for marriage is the legal joining of one man and one woman in a lifelong covenant relationship." Okay. The agency, by the way, also requires employees to adhere to their peculiar type of sane religious evangelical Christian beliefs. So essentially what HHS just did was they said, well, you know, if you're going to discriminate against Muslims and Jews and same-sex couples because it's not in line with your deeply held religious convictions and beliefs, yep, we don't have a problem with that. So that's kind of a quick news summary for this week, Ron.
Yeah, and I will have a very specific question for Shannon on that last piece. Brody, I wanted to go back to the first one about the amending the birth certificates. Is that legislation so that they can amend it, or is it against amending it?
Cannot. It's called House Bill 153, and I'm pretty sure this is probably on Shannon's plate in terms of awareness. House Bill 153 would amend the provisions in Utah law regarding the completions and amendments of a birth certificate in order to prohibit transgender citizens in Utah from being able to change the gender on their birth certificates. So, yeah, this particular piece of legislation is designed to prevent that.
And they can do that now? If you're in Utah, you can amend your birth certificate? Is that
at the current
situation?
The situation now is you can. If this goes on the books, however, no, that would alter that.
Okay. All right. So we've got a lot of legality things. I'm hoping that Shannon is sitting there furiously writing notes as we are talking behind his back.
Well, I'll give him respite for just a second. In other political news today, the United States Senate actually killed both proposed pieces of legislation that would have ended the federal shutdown, both the White House proposal, which President Trump had wanted to include funding for the wall, was shot down by the Senate. And then the what they've been referring to as the clean version that came across from the House, which is actually an early Republican version from December that Speaker Pelosi got to the House again, and it was advanced to the floor by Minority Leader Schumer, was also shot down. So at this point, okay, there's no clear path forward to ending the shutdown
right.
with the failure on both of those votes. So there you go.
And we should point out that the Democratic version got shot down less than the Republican version, though.
Yeah, that's true. The Democratic proposal failed in a 52-44 vote. The White House was a 51-47. So both needed a 60-vote majority. Neither of them got it.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a shame. That's terrible. So without further ado, we want to bring on our special guest, Shannon Minter. Shannon, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Shannon?
How are you guys? Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm right here.
So, Shannon, let's start with the subject at hand and the transgender ban. A court case raised itself to the Supreme Court. They declined not to hear it. What was the effect of that moving forward, and why did they make the decision they did?
So the government, the Trump administration, was trying very hard to get the Supreme Court to leapfrog the normal judicial process and take up the transgender military ban and decide that issue right away this term. So the good news in terms of what happened this week is that the court did not do that. The court declined to do that. That's really good news for us. We did not want the court prematurely considering this issue before we haven't even had a chance to make our case in the lower court and to present evidence to knock down all the bogus reasons the military is relying on to try to justify Trump's ban. So that was the great, great part of this week. The not-so-great part was that the court at the same time issued an order that pretty much gives a green light for the Pentagon to start enforcing the ban now if it chooses to while all these cases are proceeding. So that was a pretty big blow.
And why did they do that? Why did they allow that?
I should say, too, just so folks know, the ban is not yet being enforced. That order doesn't – it's not the kind of order that has, like, an immediate impact so that, you know, the Pentagon can immediately just start enforcing the ban. There's still a lot of other steps the government has to go through if it does decide that it wants to – you know, jump ahead and enforce the ban now, even though we don't yet know how all these court cases are going to come out. So I just want to make sure, especially any transgender service members out who may be listening or people who have friends, you know, the ban right now cannot be enforced. But stay tuned, and we all need to keep our eye on what the Pentagon is doing because, you know, that situation may change and they may get themselves in a place where they can start enforcing it sometime in the relative near future. But anyhow, as to why the court did that, you know, look, the Supreme Court is a very conservative institution generally. The Supreme Court that we now have is even more conservative, and it's not unusual for them to tell the government, you know, basically take the government's side while a case is proceeding and say that if the government wants to enforce, you know, thinks this policy is important and necessary, that the court's going to err on the side of supporting the government while the case is challenging the policy proceed. So it's not really an unusual decision in that respect. It's just that the actual impact of this policy is so awful and it's so blatantly discriminatory that it's a real blow for us and obviously a blow for all the transgender folks who are putting their lives on the line for our country.
Yeah, Shannon, I want to go back to your Brody. I want to follow up with one quick question here. You brought it up about the Pentagon not yet acting on this. The Stars and Stripes, the journalism for the military, is reporting that the Pentagon will hold off on the ban sort of implying that it does not intend to do it while the courts are still moving on this. Is that your sense, or are they just kind of working through things so they can? How imminent do you think that any implementation might be?
You know, we've gotten some mixed signals from the Pentagon on this. And, you know, just remind folks, and Brody, you and I have discussed this before, that from day one, it was so clear that the president's decision to ban transgender troops came as a total shock to the military. They were caught off guard by it, blindsided by it. They did not support it. So, it's been notable that how many military officials have found ways to make their disagreement with the policy known without directly contradicting or the president or violating their duty to obey him. So I think there's a lot of resistance to this, to reinstating the ban in the Pentagon. That said, I think, they have taken steps now to move forward with going down the road of enforcing it. Just yesterday, they filed a motion in the Maryland case, asking that court to lift its injunction, and that's the only injunction that was not in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's the only injunction that the Supreme Court stay does not touch. And that is the primary barrier right now between the military enforcing the ban. There is that federal injunction that's still in place and was not affected by the Supreme Court's order. So they have gone back to the Maryland court and asked it to lift that injunction. So they appear to be on the road of seeking to enforce the ban.
Brody?
And Shannon and I obviously have had numerous conversations about this. I think it's kind of important that we explain to the listeners that it's more of a nuanced legal morass than just a straightforward the Pentagon. It's the Justice Department, and it is U.S. attorneys. It is the acting United States Attorney General, Matt Whitaker, who is no fan of the LGBTQI community. It's the fact that the Pentagon has an acting Secretary of Defense, that the person that was most directly responsible for operations through the Secretary of Defense's office resigned. It is also nuanced by the fact that, and as Shannon said, that the service chiefs were not only caught off guard by this, but didn't see a real reason for it, including the Commandant of the Coast Guard. And I've got Pentagon sources telling me that a lot of the drive and the motivation for this is coming from the Air Force, particularly the Office of the Secretary of the Air Force. And she's got a known track record of being anti-LGBT. So, and I think, Shannon, if you could also explain the distinction and why the Maryland case is so important, because that's still a nationwide injunction and ban against them doing enforcement, correct, if I'm right, and then kind of give an explanation so that people understand that while the Pentagon is actually doing one thing, the legal battle is not being fought by the Pentagon. It is actually being fought by the Justice Department for the administration.
You're entirely correct, Brody, about all of that. Yeah, and in terms of the Maryland case, there's four challenges have been filed against the ban, one in D.C., one in Seattle, Washington, one in Riverside, California, and one in Baltimore, Maryland. All four of those federal courts issued injunctions prohibiting any enforcement of a policy banning transgender people from military service. The three of those cases have moved more quickly. The Maryland case just has been on a very slow track, for reasons that don't have anything to do with the substance of the issue. It just got the judge who was assigned to it retired, and it's just moving much more slowly. So the government was in a position to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court in three of those cases and ask the court to stay the injunctions. And in the other three cases, it was not able for legal procedural reasons to do that for the Maryland case. But the Maryland ban is a nationwide injunction. So as long as that Maryland injunction is in place, the military can't enforce the ban, you know, anywhere against anyone. So it's very significant that it exists. It's significant that the Supreme Court order did not affect that injunction. And unfortunately, it's significant that the Department of Justice did ask that Maryland court yesterday to lift the injunction. And you're right, Brody. It's, you know, that is a really important distinction. The Pentagon is the client here, is the party that's being represented by the Department of Justice, and it has no choice in that. Like, it's the Department of Justice that gets to act as the attorney for any federal agency, including the military. So the Pentagon is definitely stuck with having Department of Justice represent it. And there have been indications that the Pentagon is a very reluctant partner in this enterprise. And as you pointed out, Brody, the Pentagon itself is not a monolith by any means. You know, it has a lot of different parts and a lot of different people involved, and I think it'd probably be safe to say that there are some people in the United States military leadership structure and who strongly support the ban, and there are others, hopefully more, I think more, who do not support it at all and are very regretful that the president ever took them down this path. So it is a very complicated situation.
Shannon, in the ban itself, isn't there some kind of weakness in it in terms of a hard policy in that it has exceptions for active duty service members who are already identified as transgender, and that the ban is really on the recruitment of new recruits, which in a way, given the way this is playing out, sort of sounds like, if you're transgender and you want to be in the military, hurry up, because if this comes through, just like the door is going to shut behind you. Is that a fair assessment, or are the people who are actually serving more in danger than some of the reports?
There's three groups of people that are affected by the ban, and they are affected differently. There's people who are transgender people who are in the military now and who have come out, you know, have disclosed the fact that they're transgender and either begun or completed the process of gender transition. And the military, even under the new, even under the ban, those folks would be grandfathered in. The Mattis plan, Secretary Mattis is the, you know, person who developed a plan to implement what the president ordered. So that plan says that those folks who are already out and either already transitioned or in the transition process, they will be permitted to remain and continue to serve out their terms as openly transgender service members. However, there's many more transgender service members who have not come out. The open service policy was only in effect since June 2016, and the president tweeted that he was going to reinstate the ban just a little over a year later, July 2017. So there was only, you know, about a 12, 13-month period where people were, you know, had no reason to worry about coming out. And, you know, a lot of people did, nearly 1,000 people did, but by the military's own count, there's an additional approximately 7,000 additional transgender service members who have not yet come out. And, of course, they're not coming out under the current circumstances because they're nobody, you know, cause we don't yet know what's going to happen with this, with these losses. Mm-hmm. And coming out now would be risking your whole career. So those people are going to be very adversely affected if the ban goes into effect. I mean, they're basically going to be forced either to leave the military or to continue hiding and suppressing the fact that they're transgender, you know, which a person can only do for so long, because that definitely takes a toll. And then the last group affected is transgender people who would like to join the military. And, of course, they're just going to be completely categorically excluded from doing that if the ban goes into effect. But you can see from the just that description that the policy really doesn't make any sense. Because if it's true,
right,
the Pentagon is saying that having transgender people in the service is, you know, undermines the military readiness and causes a problem, then how can it be okay for, you know, the 1,000 people who've already come out to just continue serving? It really doesn't quite add up.
Well, I think the other part of the disconnect,
like,
too. Go ahead, Rob.
Oh, no, well, no, go ahead, Brady.
Well,
yeah.
It just seems to me there's a disconnect with that. We're watching on each other. Go ahead, Rob.
Brody, you first. There we go.
All right. Okay, Shannon, in one of our discussions, you know, a while ago, we talked about one of the arguments that was being utilized by the administration is deployability. And that was one of the foundations on which they were resting their arguments in terms of, you know, force changes and effectives for the military. And then, of course, that was all centered around the medical issues, which, for all intents and purposes, it was my understanding and from, you know, what you had told me, that there really weren't any. And I'm going to take a specific example here. Air Force Staff Sergeant Logan Ireland, who is a member of a very elite Air Force unit. This young man has already deployed in combat scenarios. He is, you know, you could just look at the staff sergeant, he looks like a lethal weapon. But if the ban was to take effect, just because he's on a certain type of regimen, they were hanging their hat on the fact that they could use that as a medical issue, which means he wouldn't be, quote unquote, deployable. Now, did I understand that correctly, or was that not one of the, you know, three, you know, seats holding up that flimsy stool of theirs in their legal construct?
Oh yeah, you know, they're trying to say that transgender people, they need a special rule to exclude transgender people because transgender people have, you know, supposed medical issues that would interfere with deployability. But that really does not make sense for at least a couple reasons. One, as you point out, there are plenty of transgender people who are deployed right now serving overseas. Some of them had multiple deployments. Logan Ireland is one of the, you know, people who've really been public and come out and you know, talk to the press. And so, but there's many, many others. So just practical experience has already shown us that there's no problem. People have no problem serving, even including under combat conditions, just because they're transgender. But the other reason, just the most basic reason, is that the military already has a universal standard about deployability. Anybody who's has any kind of medical condition that causes them to be non-deployable for more than 12 months is out, it can be discharged. And in order to be deployable, you have to meet all kinds of, you know, standards of fitness and ability to serve. So, you know, those standards already exist. They apply to every single person in the military, including to every single transgender person. So, by definition, the only thing that having a special rule that says transgender people have to be excluded just because they're transgender, the only thing that rule actually accomplishes is to get rid of people who meet all those other standards. Like, you're getting rid of people who meet the very same standards you're applying to every other service member, who meet the fitness standards, who meet the deployability standards, but you're going to get rid of them just because they're transgender. Like, it really, it's fundamental, just on such a basic fundamental level, this whole policy does not make sense, which is why, even though we do have a very conservative Supreme Court, that's why I think if we're given a chance to litigate these cases in the lower courts, that by the time we get to build that record and are back up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, I actually think we will win because the very thing I just said, there's just a fundamental irrationality at the heart of this policy that I think I don't think even a very conservative Supreme Court is going to be able to ignore.
No, Shannon, that actually you brought up a question I had earlier, but So I'm picking my best questions here. If you looked at the makeup of the Supreme Court now, and especially looking at the five justices that voted against, hearing this, who is your, and I'm going to use this in a euphemistic term, who's the weakest link for the conservative side, for the Trump administration, of the conservative team that you would target as the one to probably vote down the ban, even though they're considered a conservative justice?
It's really hard. It's really hard to know that. I'm a little reluctant to, speculate about how individual justices might vote. But I will say, we really don't know much yet about how Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch are going to approach almost any kind of case, because they're so new to the court. But there have been, glimmers of hope, I would say, that Justice Gorsuch already has joined in some interesting opinions, and sometimes joint opinions with the so-called more liberal members of the court. I think just Chief Justice Roberts is very concerned about the integrity and credibility of the court as an institution, and I think that he is going to take this case very, very seriously and make sure that any decision they reach is actually grounded in the law and not just a knee-jerk endorsement of a Trump administration policy. And look, I just can't stress enough how much the facts are on our side in this case. I mean, there is no legitimate reason to exclude transgender people from military service. None of the reasons that the military has put forward make a lick of sense, and they do not have any footing whatsoever in actual medical science. So if we're given a chance, possibly even to have some trials in these cases and, test and challenge these justifications that the military's put forward, we'll be able to depose folks, we'll be able to put expert witnesses on, talking about the medical evidence, talking about the record of transgender people in the service. I think we will have a record that is so powerful and so strong that, like I said, I think even very conservative justices are going to be given pause, and I think really realize that they have got to take a hard look at this.
Which brings a question, and this is to follow up with what Rob's question was, Shannon. This was unusual, okay? The administration through the Justice Department, and quite frankly, I will point fingers at the Attorney General, the acting Attorney General. This was them trying to do a procedural end run by asking these things be lifted through what would be a normal process with these other courts, was it not? In other words, these things were proceeding. There was a political or other impetus to run to the court and try to get the court to go out of turn into terms of walking around the district court judges and the circuit court judges, or is my impression of that mistaken?
Oh, you're absolutely correct. The Trump administration has done this repeatedly now. Perhaps they got the wrong signal from the Supreme Court when the court upheld the travel ban. And that really was, a pretty disappointing decision, and the reasoning was awfully threadbare, I have to say. But I think perhaps the Department of Justice thought, oh, well, this is great. We can just run to the Supreme Court anytime a Trump administration policy is challenged, and they will, they're going to bail us out and protect us, quote unquote, from these lower courts that are actually examining our policies and finding many of them to be unconstitutional. So, yeah, I definitely think that they had high hopes that the Supreme Court would protect them. They do not want this policy to be scrutinized. The last thing they want is to have to be in a federal court actually presenting whatever evidence they have to support it, because they don't, I am quite confident they don't have that evidence, and they know that. I mean, they think they know very well that there is no substance to the arguments they're making about the supposedly negative effects of transgender military service, and I think they know they're not going to be able to back that up. There may also be things about the process itself that they really don't want to have come to light. So I think they're doing everything they can to avoid having either their process or the policy itself subject to any judicial scrutiny. And they very much wanted the Supreme Court to just bail them out and protect them, take the case now, decide it on a, you know, paper-thin record, and, you know, uphold the policy. But that did not happen. That's why it's very significant that the court declined review of these cases at this time.
Shannon, I want to move to one of the other legal areas that we talked about at the top of the show, and that's the case about the adoption agency and discrimination on religious grounds against Muslim couples or same-sex couples. One of the things, and I'm a parent, adopted two baby boys through foster care. As a gay dad, you know, with my then partner. And I actually, when I hear about this case, the thing that irritates me the most about it is not the parental rights of potential same-sex couples who want to adopt, but I come to it more from the needs of the kids being adopted, that I feel like their best protections are being violated by the exclusion of different parenting couples that could understand and raise them more appropriately. Specifically, gay or transgender or gender fluid kids in the system that are going to be forced into homes that are mandating this religious philosophy that in many cases lead to, you know, quote-unquote reparative therapy or putting that child in psychological danger. Is there a multiple legal strategy to go after that besides just going after the rights of same-sex couples, or is there any advocacy for the kids that are placed in that situation at all?
Yeah, very excellent. That is an excellent point. You're right. The people who are most harmed by that decision is just completely unprecedented, by the way. Never before has the federal government told a federally funded adoption agency that it's okay to discriminate based on religion and sexual orientation. But I mean, the religious part is really almost more shocking. I mean, they have now told this federally funded adoption agency that they can literally turn people away because of their religious faith, because they're Jewish or Muslim or any religion other than the particular brand of Christianity that this agency endorses. That's pretty shocking. And yeah, the who's mostly hurt by that, though, are the kids that need placements. It is very well established in law and child welfare policy that every single adoption decision is supposed to be based on the best interests of the individual child. You're supposed to look at all the characteristics and circumstances of that child and try to match them with the best parents for the child. And as you point out, particularly if you have a gay or a transgender child, it's hard to see how it would be in their best interest to be placed with a family who thinks that being gay or transgender is a problem or something that should be changed. I mean, we know that will be devastating for those kids. And I mean, but that's just one example, though. I mean, it basically deprives every single child that's being placed by this agency of an individualized determination of that child's best interest and which family would be the best suited for that particular child. So it's a pretty terrible this is a terrible development. I mean, this is a really, you know, historic day in a negative sense for our country, because boy, we just crossed the line today that never before has the federal government crossed, and we're now over it. And it certainly makes me worry about similar decisions that will be coming out of this HHS.
Well, that also raises the question for me, you know, in addition to child care and foster care placement and agencies like this, and Shannon, you and I have discussed religious freedom laws and their impact, and, of course, the defense that's being raised by your legal adversaries, which would be the Thomas More Center in Detroit, the Alliance Defending Freedom in Scottsdale, Arizona, and, of course, our friends Liberty Council in Orlando, Florida. But it seems to me that the stage is being set, at least in a legal sense, to just run one challenge after the other by the religious right into these federal courts. And that one of the things that really concerns me, and I wanted you to comment on this, is we're seeing the challenges now also being set up to go after Roe v. Wade. And that, pardon me for extrapolating, but I think that taking it from that, running it all the way back, that could potentially put Windsor or even Obergefell in some sort of legalistic jeopardy. Give me your impressions on that, would you?
Yeah, I think the strategy of the anti-LGBT organizations, including the ones that you just mentioned, are to set up cases now in the hopes that they can get this new, very conservative Supreme Court to create some new law that says that religious, the so-called free exercise clause in the Constitution that protects the right to free exercise of religion, if that clause requires mandates, exemptions to anti-discrimination laws and all kinds of other laws, I think that is their goal. And they may succeed. It is entirely possible that there may be 5 votes on the court to create new law and mandate religious exemptions to not just laws about protecting LGBT people from discrimination, but all anti-discrimination laws. I think that's what they're after. I do think that they're more focused on that than they are on reversing Obergefell or Windsor. Because if they can establish that there's a free exercise exception to anti-discrimination laws and to the basic requirement of equality, they have that will mean that married same-sex couples will not be treated equally in many parts of the country and in many parts of their life. If adoption agencies or businesses or employers or what have you can just invoke a religious liberty right, so-called right to not respect those marriages, then, you know, that's just as good probably in their book as reversing Obergefell itself. So I think that's the path they will go down. And I do agree with you. They also definitely have their eyes on the goal of reversing Roe v. Wade. But I think that is because they really want to take the right to abortion away from women in this country. I don't think it's a vehicle for, in their minds, for reversing Obergefell.
Okay. Now, the only reason I was asking is because that point had been raised, and then I participated in the editorial and journalistic roundtable earlier this week, and this was actually after the decision Tuesday, and we also were looking at the fact that looking at what happened with Health and Human Services with this adoption agency, then we also look at the decision that was made in the Masterpiece Cake case out of Colorado. And so that's why I asked you that question. It is because we were looking at those two along with what had happened with the transmilitary scenario, and we were wondering, well, could this actually be the strategy that they're going after? In other words, is this their legal exit strategy, if you will, Rob?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to shift gears again, and by gears I mean guns. And Shannon, I wanted to ask you about the Supreme Court's acceptance of this guns right case out of New York and what your take was on that and where you think that might go.
Well, it's been a long time since the court accepted a gun rights case. The conventional wisdom here is that they're doing it now because the more conservative justices on the court must be thinking that they have a fifth vote now to strike down this law, and it's quite likely that they do. I think the question really is not how that case is going to come out, because I'm afraid the result there is pretty much been forecast by the court taking a gun rights case for the first time in such a long time. I mean, it's pretty clear they're going to strike it down. The real question will come in, what do they say in their opinion? How broad is it or how narrow is it? I mean, this law, it is a somewhat unusual law, and it would be possible to strike it down just on very narrow grounds. But it would also be possible, of course, to issue a very broad opinion that would lead to striking down laws that are less unusual than this one. And the New York law in this case, I mean, they picked a law that is somewhat vulnerable to being struck down because it has some kind of paradoxical results in its application. It just makes it difficult. You can have a gun in New York, you can travel with it, but you can't travel with it outside of state lines. And, some people live right on the border, and it can seem kind of frustrating or arbitrary to them that they can't just travel right over the state line with their gun. So, they picked a law that is in some ways maybe an easier target than others, and they're going to strike it down. I think that's clear. The real question is how narrowly or broadly will they rule?
Fair enough. Shannon, I'm going to circle back on something that is just, it's kind of been bugging me a little bit. I had a conversation earlier this week with a board member of Sparta, a friend of the show, a good friend of mine, you know her as well, Bryn Tannehill. And Bryn was bringing up the point that it seems like there's a full court press now, particularly targeting the rights of transgender individuals across a much wider spectrum into the schools, the military. You're the legal director of NCLR. Do you, from your perspective, do you guys see an increase in your caseload or maybe you're hearing more things about that actually going on? I mean, but Bryn's perception is that the administration seems to be really geared hard at targeting the trans community as almost it's a specific effort, and then once they're done with the trans community, they're going to try the rest of the acronym. Do you mind just giving me a little bit of a, how do you think and what do you look at when you hear something like that coming?
Yes, I agree with Bryn, and she's terrific, by the way, and she has a great new book. That's everything you ever wanted to know but were afraid to ask about transgender people, something along those lines. May not have the title quite right, but it's a really great resource. Yeah, I completely agree with her. This administration has transgender people very squarely in its sights. It is coming after the transgender community relentlessly in every single area, and it is in a very consistent way. They really want to make it impossible for transgender people to get access to transition-related care. They want to make it impossible for transgender people to work, to go to school, to serve in the military, you name it. Their assessment, I believe, is that transgender people are such a small, vulnerable population, and that we don't yet have established rights and protections, and we don't yet have the same degree of public understanding and support that the LGB community has, that gay people have. And I think that they are true believers. I really believe that the primary forces behind this in the Trump administration are Pence and other religious anti-LGBT groups that genuinely think that being transgender is sinful and moral and that people should not do it. And I actually think they can stamp out the community and may, and create a world in which it is legally impossible to live openly as a transgender person. And I guess they think they're, you know, saving our souls by making us live in our birth sex. So yeah, it's pretty scary. It's a pretty scary time to be a transgender person in the United States right now.
Agreed.
Yeah, and thank you for calling out Bryn's book. We've had Bryn on this show, and I've had Bryn on out in Santa Cruz discussing her book, Everything You Wanted to Know About Being Trans But Were Afraid to Ask. And it is like a real go-to manuscript in terms of understanding that, and extremely well-researched. It's not just one trans person's opinion. It's really done in depth. One thing, this is a little off of the pure legal arena, but could you share some of your thoughts on Mrs. Pence and her sideline career at the Conservative Christian School, and what that says about the executive enforcement arm of our government that is being run by somebody who is obviously in allegiance with a cross between the separation of church and state?
Yeah, I can. You know, it's interesting you ask about that. You know, I think to me this is a situation where it's important that we, and by we I mean, you know, the LGBT community, the broader progressive community, that we also acknowledge that religious liberty is actually important. I mean, I hate the way that the religious right is abusing it and exploiting it to try to justify discrimination and to change the laws, to create these sweeping new exemptions to anti-discrimination laws, which would just be so devastating for our country. It'd be so harmful, and that's not the way the law has ever operated in this country. And it's part of what makes us a unified country is that we agree that in the public realm, you know, especially with any publicly funded activities, that everybody has to be treated equally, and we can't let people just pick and choose who they're going to serve or help or employ based on characteristics like their race or religion or gender and so forth. Anyhow, but look, I actually think that if she wants to work for a private religious school, that she has every right in the world to do that. And the fact that she's married to the vice president doesn't change that fact. You know, of course, I don't like the school's policy. I think they're, you know, really, it sends such a harmful message to LGBT young people to be told that they're not welcome in that school. That's rough, you know, and I hate to think of the impact of that on young people in our community. At the same time, look, she has a right to teach there if she wishes to, and I think we should be careful about how we criticize her for doing that. You know, I think we just really need to remember that you know, people do have the freedom to practice their religion, and it's a private school, and you know, they do have the ability legally to have whatever policies they want about who they will accept and who they won't accept, even if we don't agree with them.
Yeah, I agree with you in terms of her as a private citizen and her right to do that. I guess my question was more in lines of some parallels to Donald Trump's tweets about the bans and how the courts looked at those and read in intent coming from those. And I realize she is her and not her husband, and she is not a legally elected part of the executive branch, but, and so it's definitely a stretch, but whether there isn't some proximity to bias by her doing that, especially when there are cases that are driven by the policies of this administration that they are trying to present as being separate from biases that we are very aware exist.
Well, I would not. I would not go there personally, because it would be, it's theoretically perfectly possible for somebody to, you know, hold those religious beliefs and practice them in their own life, and yet simultaneously recognize that LGBT people are part of this country and have a right to exist and have a right to be treated equally, and support, you know, and support laws that protect them. And, you know, so I just wouldn't, I personally just would not go down that path. I mean, we have enough direct, unmistakable evidence that this administration is going after our community with, like, dangerous, hateful federal policies that are coming right at us. I think we should, this is, again, just my view, I don't think that we need to try to, you know, use the fact that the vice president's wife works for a religious school that excludes gay students to sort of bolster our case that this administration
right.
is against us. You know, let's just look at what they're actually doing.
It's not a hidden secret, right? Absolutely.
No,
Brody?
It's not a secret. No.
Well, to our listeners, since we're kind of running down the clock here, I wanted to mention that, and I said it earlier, Shannon is the legal director for the National Center for Lesbian Rights. If you have a legal issue or a question, and you need, and you're LGBTQI and you're part of the community and you need their help, the legal helpline for the National Center for Lesbian Rights is 1-800-528-6257, or in the San Francisco Bay Area, you can reach them at 415-392-6257, and you can read all about them at www.nclrrights.org. That's www.nclrrights.org. And Rob, I'll throw it at you. And Shannon, as always, it's so good to talk to you, my friend. Rob?
Yeah, Shannon, I just want to, first of all, thank you for coming on again. Your voice is incredibly important. You're so informative. And apart from what you shared tonight being really helpful, I think I've just been riveted and fascinated with everything you've said. I think your insights are really, really brilliant. But I also want to thank you, more importantly, for the work you do. Let's face it, we as a community rely on you and your team and the other advocacy teams like you so much. We would not be anywhere without your hard work and efforts for us all. So, I mean, deep, deep, deep thank you, thank you, thank you for who you are and what you're doing for us. Brody, I want to thank you for being on, as always, and your brilliance that you bring to the show and everything else. I also want to remind our listeners that if you enjoyed our program tonight, we are back every Thursday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and then all the various time zones in between. Pending, of course, electrical storms out here in California, which derailed us last week. Our apologies on that. But also, we have Out in Santa Cruz on Saturday nights, which you can hear on www.ksco.com. And that is also at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we take a little more cultural bent, from RuPaul's Drag Race to the Academy Awards and everything in between, along with some political chatter. Also, that is definitely a show that you want to catch if you are interested in all things LGBTQ. So for Brody and myself, we want to thank you very much for listening and being part of all this. You are important to us. And we look forward to bringing you more of the same again next week in this very same time and this very same channel. We will talk to you then.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio!